Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
It is officially Super Bowl week, one of the most fun times of the year. And a documentary on the Ravens came out this week. So much to talk about on Pod Like a Raven. So we almost were doomed, in a sense, with having no Ravens things to talk about, really, and only focusing on the Super Bowl, which is fine and fun. And then I forgot that a perfectly timed Ravens-related documentary was released Sunday night, and we have a lot to talk about. With it, I am Antonio Barbera, and I'm joined by my two co-hosts. Coming right off the documentary, let's start on the East Coast, Tim Horsey. Tim, I don't know if you're going to watch the Oscars or not this year, but you think Bullies of Baltimore should be a Best Picture candidate.
I think it should be a Best Picture candidate. I absolutely love this documentary. Was I a little inebriated watching it? Yes. Did that make my viewing experience better? Yes. But getting to see Tony Saragusa and that just colorful cast of characters that we'll get into more detail was such a perfect way to end the weekend, especially a weekend of no football, because I'll just do this now. I didn't watch any of the Pro Bowl like I told you I would. I don't lie to our listeners here on Pod Like a Raven. Didn't see a minute of it or any of the balloon toss or whatever the hell they were doing in Las Vegas this year. But yeah, that was a nice way to do it for probably, you know, the team that I fell in love with football, the team that made me fall in love with football, I should say. It was nice kind of getting a rehash on that, and this is going to go into the Oscars don't matter, frankly. So in Tim's Oscars, this is joining the pantheon of movies that I will watch over and over and over again. This joins The Departed. This joins Dark Knight. Bullies of Baltimore is right there as, oh, it's a Tuesday night and I don't know what to do. I'm just gonna flip this on and smile for an hour. It was fantastic.
It is good to know that me personally that I'm starting the week 1-0 after having locked in the under 12 minutes that Tim was going to watch Pro Bowl activities this weekend. Yeah. So it's a good confidence booster as we get into some prop bets and some picks for the Super Bowl. On the West Coast, Jace Evans. Jace, Bullies of Baltimore, Sunday night. What'd you think of it?
I loved it. I mean, I told some friends after watching this that, you know, this documentary was engineered in a lab for me to enjoy a documentary on, you know, the best team, I'd say, you know, apologies to the 2019 Ravens, but, you know, the team that got it done, best start to finish season in team history, and just all these guys that, you know, we grew up with, and Ray Lewis, and all the Jamal Lewis, and it was just so good, and so I was predisposed to like it, and I loved it. I liked it, you know, more, I think, than the America's Game documentary, even, but did not watch the Pro Bowl either. Like Tim, did not watch a second. The only thing I saw all weekend, which made me, you know, I feel bad for him because you never want to see someone get hurt, but it gave me a little morbid chuckle because, of course, this would happen to the Browns, is Myles Garrett dislocated his toe at the Pro Bowl games, which is just a very Browns thing to happen. You know, they're not even playing football anymore, and they still have their best player suffer an injury, so he'll be fine. I think we've all dislocated toes before, or at least broken toes, but yeah, just not probably how you want to start your offseason if you're Myles Garrett. So that's the extent of my Pro Bowl knowledge, but as for Bullies of Baltimore, I'm with Tim. Art's subjective, but this was objectively a great movie for me, at least personally. But yeah, I really enjoyed it, and I'm kind of excited to sort of talk a little more with you guys about it.
I love it. All right, so for the listeners, we will get to the Super Bowl. We promise that we have that slated for the second half of the show, but we need to talk about Bullies of Baltimore. And I'm going to shout this out as loud as I can without bothering anybody's ears. this will be a spoiler, like, spoiler alert right now, because you may not have seen it yet. You may want to watch it, you know, do the ESPN Plus situation. You may catch it in a few days, you may catch it in a few weeks. We will not save you from that in the next 20 to 30 minutes. We're going to be very detail-oriented, so just, you know, skip ahead to 20, 25 minutes if you do not want to miss sort of the specifics of what came in here. But we all saw it, and we're going to talk about it. So it's funny. You guys each, I think, loved it. I saw the text thread was hopping. I liked it. I'm not going to go so far as to say I loved it. I loved the subject matter. I loved re-watching this dominant defense pitch shutout after shutout and then win the first Super Bowl for all three of us. It was right at the age that we're becoming fans, like understanding what fanhood is at like 10, 11 years old. But I did not enjoy the format that they chose compared to most sports documentaries. I guess they just... I mean, this is... It's an ESPN production. It's separate from what they ended up using a bunch of, which was that event in Baltimore, that, like, round table with a couple of ex-Raven players and Kevin Byrne, who has been there, like, director, communications guy or so, 18 different roles for the franchise for a long time. I didn't like the choice of using that as opposed to just having enough interviews that you had done to stream together the story. They had to use Kevin Byrne a lot as a pivot to talk about different topics. And I thought it started a little bit slow. I thought those long clips from the event in Baltimore at times was a bit... It almost got, like, awkward kind of thing, like, where you're kind of chuckling along with the audience of an event that's not a live event anymore. It's recorded, but also you're splicing in the interviews of some of the players at a different time as opposed to the interviews that they're doing during the event. So I was kind of lost with that, and I was surprised that they chose it, but I would think that decision may have come from the death of Tony Siragusa, which I think, you know, the whole structure of this show really ended up being around his death. They opened with that, they closed with that, and they had a ton of clips from him from that event. Mm-hmm. So I do wonder if the arc of the documentary was impacted by the timing of that. I think he died a month after that event was held, which is crazy timing that he was there to talk and share all these stories and fun tidbits so close to his, you know, obviously unfortunate death. But I'd be curious to know if they had a different plan for it beforehand as opposed to after. But I liked it. Didn't know if I loved this, the using so much from that event.
I kind of feel the same way to Antonio, and it, you know, obviously this isn't the world we live in, but if there was like an alternate cut of like what their original sort of plan would be, I would be kind of curious about that. But I also did think, obviously, the Goose stuff I think gave it a level of kind of poignancy I guess I wasn't expecting going into it. Certainly about, like, you know, like especially at the end when it, you know, they're all hugging and saying love you and like all that, and like the power of team and that kind of thing. And how, like, you know, these memories last forever, all those kind of themes. Certainly gave it, I think, a level of sort of meaning, I think, that was probably deeper than what the original was, which the original version was probably like, remember these guys who, like, talked all this trash and then, like, beat your behind and they didn't care? Like, so it probably, I guess, gave it certainly a level of emotional depth. But I was with you. I was curious kind of just that alternate world of like, what would this documentary be if, you know, if Goose was still with us? And I certainly think it would probably have taken a little bit of a different path and just been more about just the in your face personalities and less certainly the emotional sort of tugging on the heartstrings kind of side of things.
I mean, I'm not going to say I completely disagree with you guys. I just didn't notice it as a negative. Like, I didn't, it just, I thought it was.
Yeah, I don't know if you think it's a negative. I just think, I'm curious, like, what would be different, I guess.
Sure. I thought it was an interesting angle and kind of a new way to do something. As somebody who spends most of my workday trying to find new angles to talk about things that aren't just the same old boring crap all the time. You know, yeah, Liev Schreiber doing the like voiceover and getting these interviews and stuff would have been cool. Don't get me wrong, and I think it still would have worked. The Saragusa stuff I thought they handled really well. Obviously, there's an emotional tinge to it, but I also think that they got the message across that this was a team that talked a lot of stuff, and I'm going to try really hard not to say the other S word, and backed it up. You know, playing against us was hell. The clip that from Shannon Sharp, yeah, if you thought we said it, we said it. Everything you think we said, we said it. And, you know, Goose, I just want to kind of get into some of the major aspects of stuff that we did, like, outside of this. And I have two main ones. First of all, the candor, obviously, that you hear. But the two stars, and we'll start with Goose because you guys brought him up. There's a reason that guy was so good on television for so long after his career. I mean, the stories he told, telling Phil's, like, and this is the thing I think I liked about the audience thing, where, look, only Ravens fans are going to that thing. And so they're going to ham it up for Ravens fans. And that's what this documentary was for. Like, this was not for your Browns fans, which this was for general NFL fans, excuse me, like the history of the league, who don't have a problem with the Ravens, and the Ravens fans, which is, you know, a smaller contingent. But hearing the story about, you know, Phil Simms losing his mind about the Rich Gannon thing, and they're telling all this, like, kind of in the background, and it's like, yeah, he went after him, and then this is just coming from the article recapping it on BaltimoreRavens.com, quote, during production meetings before Super Bowl 35, Saragusa told Simms that he was putting up new landscaping at his house. They both lived in Jersey. And that if he saw those plants dug up, he would know where to find him. And then they cut to Goose at this event, knowing he's going to get a pop from the crowd, going, Phil Simms can kiss my ass. And the crowd pops. And like that, I think that kind of stuff, because I'm sitting there with my girlfriend, who is probably incredibly annoyed at me at this point. I'd already done about 15 squirrel dances, jumping up and down, talking about like different moments throughout the season. And I like cheered at that, like, and laughed and like clapped along. And I kind of think that crowd aspect maybe enhanced that a little bit. The other guy who I think was just incredible, and we'll talk, and Antonio's done a really good job of kind of stretching out some of the finer points of the documentary, but just overall, Brian Billick was the star of that thing. And, you know, we've talked about it when we've had the Harbaugh discussion of, we always thought Billick was a good coach, but at some point it was time to go. Billick was so good for that team. He was arrogant, and I forgot how arrogant he was, and they showed up. I'm just behind the scenes for everybody. I'm literally going to watch this again tonight as we sign off. I'm going to, like, throw it on the iPad while I'm cooking dinner or what have you. He knew he held that team accountable and said they had to back it up, but he brought not only his own arrogance, but allowed these guys to be arrogant. And just getting the quotes, playing against us was hell. And, like, you know, obviously the famous F tennis, F the Titans thing afterwards, where he's like, turn the cameras off, turn the cameras off, turn the cameras off. And somebody didn't. And you get that moment. Him just talking about knowing that they were going to be a pain in the ass for everybody in the league, and they wanted it that way, and they carried that swagger with them the entire time. It also made me think, Brian, he's probably a bit too old at this point. Billick would be a hell of a coach now, because now we're in the player empowerment era of letting guys be themselves and what have you. And I think it, in his younger days, I don't think he's, you know, I think he's kind of out of coaching at this point. And again, this is rose-tinted glasses. We were literally watching a documentary gassing him up. So there was definitely negatives, and there were definitely negatives during the Baltimore era as well. I think he would make an incredible coach today. And he was – I always loved Brian Billick, obviously. You know, brought this town a Super Bowl and had a great attitude. And as a young kid, you know, at training camp in Westminster, he signed a couple things for me, and he was always, always generous with his time to the kids and what have you. And, like, I – and my parents – you know, we've always respected him for that, obviously, because they don't have to do that stuff, and he was always one of those guys that would. He was the star of the show, and a pleasant surprise for me during that entire production.
You mentioned the arrogance. It is easy to, like, to forget. I think what I like
was awesome. Just awesome.
I probably did like the archive clips more necessarily than the like the round table, but I did enjoy some of the candor in the stories. 'Cause certainly, you know, I like the America's Game documentaries, But they're produced by NFL Films, which means they're an NFL product. And the NFL does not touch on certain things, like, you know, Tony Siragusa being backed up, or him telling Phil Simms he can kiss his ass, or that kind of thing. So, you know, I really liked it from that. That's what I liked most about this documentary, is because, like, we did know a lot of the stories, and I certainly, like, you know, there were things they didn't touch on that maybe they should have, but, like, that as a fan, I know, like, with, like, Jermaine Lewis's son and some of that kind of stuff from that season that they just didn't go into. And, you know, one guy who wasn't there who kind of surprised me, Jonathan Ogden, barely involved. They talked to an archive. They show one archive clip of him. And, like, they don't mention, like, they don't talk to Peter Boulware at all. So there's all, like, weird sort of player choices and stuff. But, like, as someone who already knows a ton about the team, what I liked was just the kind of the further stories and, you know, just kind of hearing those. So that's why I think it worked for me, is because I do already bring so much knowledge of that team kind of into the Enterprise to just sort of hear more about it. That's why I just think it worked for me. And yeah, Tim's right. Syracuse, obviously, and then Billick. With Billick, it was just, like, it was things you knew at the time. Like, I remember, like, my dad and I talking about how, like, how arrogant he was and stuff like that, like, back in the day. But, like, it was just a good reminder of, like, when he's standing up there and they're like, what right do you have to tell us how to do our job? And he's like, because you're all, I'm up at the podium and you're listening to me, like, all that kind of stuff. You're just like, oh man, yeah, this guy. But he worked for that team, as you said. So that's what I liked, I think, most about the documentary, was just kind of hearing these stories that, yeah, you know, you hadn't heard before.
And there were some fun little tidbits that they did during the documentary and during the event itself. Bringing Tim Williams back to redo his impression of Shannon Sharp was awesome. The Siragusa talking about how he almost signed with the Raiders and then he took a night to sleep on the deal that was offered and then accepted it the next day, and Al Davis just arbitrarily dropped the deal by $50,000, and the most Tony Siragusa thing ever is to say, well, bye, then I'm not doing that. And then seeing him again at the AFC title game when they won the Super Bowl and telling him, I hope those $50,000 were worth it to you because you lost out on a Super Bowl because of it. The guy on the roof that didn't leave the roof for 5 weeks until the Ravens scored a touchdown, and then bringing him back for the event. He must have been like 75 years old, and they had him in the audience for the event. And that tidbit specifically reminded me, because Tim, I want to keep talking about Billick, because that is, I do think he was great in the documentary, and then also the aspect of, he was an offensive coordinator in Minnesota. He was the offensive mind brought to Baltimore to bring points and then just complement an already really, really good defense. And the offense didn't score a touchdown for 5 weeks. And he somehow, maybe his biggest job, he somehow did not lose the locker room in between these 5 weeks of not scoring a touchdown, not scoring points between the offense and the defense. He's able to keep things afloat. He's able to keep harmony and unity in a team that had a lot of voices, had a lot of personalities, and keep the ship steady, and then, you know, run on that long streak of wins until they went all the way and won the Super Bowl. So nice to get some more appreciation for Billick, when a lot of the, I think, Baltimore fans' final memories is him sort of losing control and kind of stinking the last few years, and it finally being time for him to go. Whereas, hey, he did a lot of good things as a head coach outside of not being able to do the same things that Randy Moss and Chris Carter did and bringing those, you know, those things to Baltimore without that talent offensively.
Yeah, I mean, I get so wistful, and I think the other thing I enjoyed about this was this most recent Raven season, Antonio, was just so miserable for me that to, like, watch a documentary of, like, what, like, just for which for me was just enjoyable, like, just pure bliss, like, watching that Super Bowl, you know, we're in third grade, I believe, and, like, I never for a minute, like, thought the Ravens would lose the game, like, because I was just, like, dumb and young and naive. I'm like, oh yeah, they're great, like, of course they're gonna win the Super Bowl. And, like, I just remember, like, that whole night just being, like, a basically celebrate, like, certainly after Dwayne Stark's pick six, like, a celebration, just, like, with my family. We had, like, I think my aunt and uncle over, And yeah, it was great. And like, you just to like sort of to live in those memories, and then that era sort of extended as a whole. And I think one thing I do want to bring up and touch on, and there's a million different topics to touch on him, because he's a very complicated individual to me and to Ravens franchise history, is Ray Lewis. I had this thought cross my head, and I jotted this down as watching this game. I think Ray is simultaneously the corniest and also the most genuine person of all time. And the comparison I wrote is he's Russell Wilson if Russell Wilson wasn't acting. Like, this is just what he is. He's just, like, over the top. These are two different quotes I jotted down, maybe not verbatim, but at one point Ray said the line, "Gladiator changed my life." That's the Russell Crowe movie. And a different,
which is insane.
At a different point, insane. He said, "I always was a fan of the Serengeti." Talking about Lions, and he's just like I don't know. I've gone back and forth. Like, Ray Lewis is my favorite football player of all time. He's a very complicated man. I'm back in on Ray. I think in general, lately, I think I've accepted, like, this is actually who he is. It's not a front. He's just like a bizarre guy. Extremely weird, but I don't know. Yet obviously, I mean, even in this documentary, like, getting lifted up through the floor with like the Lombardi trophy and stuff, like, it's all, everything with him is just so ridiculous, and yet it's somehow he makes it work. Like, the inspiration of the locker room, the speeches, the squirrel dance, as Tim talked about, is iconic. And I think for me, that pick six against the Titans is, I think, still for me, my favorite play in Ravens history. I was watching it at a family friend's house when it happened, and it's the best play by the greatest player in franchise history. I don't know how, I understand the Mile High Miracle fans. That was incredible too. But for me, I think that has to be number one, because, what it meant at the time, shushing that stadium that had never lost a game in that, the Titans had never lost since that arena or that stadium opened like 2 years before then. It was just great. It was a huge, or I guess they lost in the regular season to the Ravens, but it was just an incredible moment, a rivalry that still somehow remains real to this day, the Ravens and Titans. One of the better behind, I'd say, the AFC North rivalries, certainly right there for the Ravens with the Titans. I think that was the top play for me, but yeah, and then obviously they touched on it, but Ray's legal situation, I guess we'll call it. I don't know if that they would delve into that at all. I don't know that they used the most tact they could have in addressing it. Like, we were talking pre-show, they showed a clip of Gladiator from the movie, like, within 30 seconds of talking about this extremely serious situation where two guys died. I don't know how you tastefully handle it. I'm surprised they addressed it at all, but, like, they kind of had to. So I'm glad they did, but that was just another thing. Just kind of put a whole bow on it. Ray Lewis, a very complicated individual that, obviously, shaped the first 17 years of franchise history. So there's a lot going on with him, and I think this documentary just sort of reaffirmed all that for me.
It's interesting you'd say that too, because, like, he wasn't used as much, and I think it's because I completely agree with what you're saying. This is Ray. This is not a front. This is who this guy is. He literally says Gladiator motivates him. Like, but you believe it because it's Ray Lewis, and that's just who this guy is. But you could tell that they didn't use him as much as the Tony Siragusa and the Brian Billick and Shannon Sharp, who you should mention, was excellent, as you expected. The whole, like, pranking stuff that he did with Goose and everything, too, during training camp and what have you, I think was awesome. But they didn't use him because we kind of know with Ray. Like, we kind of know what Ray is, and Ray can get you pumped up for a game. He can get you into the lion's den with a spear screaming like a banshee. I know that's a Billick line, but you kind of needed the attitude. I mean, he is the one that dropped the we were hell to play against, but he was certainly not the highlight of this for me. And maybe it's just oversaturation with Ray, too. Like, I don't have – what is he on now? Showtime? Is he on the Inside the NFL on Showtime or something now?
No, I didn't realize that, but
– exactly. I don't have Showtime, and now that's why I don't get over you know, I'm always going to love Ray. I will. He's probably my second favorite player of all time because Ed Reed's the GOAT. But I don't get a lot of Ray in my life, so you can take him in small doses. And I think they had just the right amount of Ray here. I don't know how much more we're going to go on this. I know Antonio's got a few more things, too. I do just want to mention one of the best parts of it. I was actually just pulled it up in like a silence tab, and I was scrubbing through it to make sure that we got some stuff. I mean, the Tony Siragusa diarrhea, whatever, backed up story. The backed up story is all time. Please go watch it again if you haven't seen that. And maybe this is recency bias, and it's a very small part of the podcast, but I remember going through, and I'm looking at my texts now. I did text you guys about this as well. In week four, the Bengals had 4 yards rushing and 94 yards of total offense. And Corey Dillon walked off the field. Quit. He walked off the field. He quit. He quit. You know what, Bengals fans? That's what you are. Never forget, that's what you are. You're not the team now, because guess what? You talked all the crap, and you didn't back it up. You wanted to be the 2000 Ravens, where all you did was spout your mouth off Eli Apple and then win the big game. But you couldn't do it because you're the Bengals. You're quitters, and that's what you are. Corey Dillon encapsulates the entirety of what Cincinnati is. And when I saw that clip, it made me so happy to watch him I don't even know who the coach was at the time, just some no-name generic white. And he, like, it just, like, is, like, pointing at the field so sheepishly of, like, are you gonna go back out there? And Corey Dillon quit on his team because it was too hard to play against the Ravens. Yeah, there might have been a shot from left field, I know, but I just that made me so, so happy to see.
The hits were unreal to watch.
Unreal! Like, awesome!
Like, I think, like, they would have been flagged for unnecessary roughness on, I think, 50% of the plays, some of the hits. And, I mean, what I loved, though, was standing by it. Like, I understand, like, the Siragusa and Sim stuff was great. That was a cheap hit. Like, he shouldn't have been kicked out of the game or anything.
Nah.
But it was a cheap shot. But to, like, just everyone maintain, like, nah, that was clean. I loved it.
Clean.
Like, I love, like, just, it embodied everything they stood for. And just, I guess, a final kind of, we kind of mentioned it, but a goose point. Like, it obviously was sad, but I am glad this documentary happened, because it serves as, like, a nice encapsulation of his life, right? Like, and a celebration of his life and the man, like, you know, you don't get that much. We sort of saw a very similar thing to this was when that Madden documentary from last year that came out on him, and he died shortly after that. Obviously, he was much, much older than Tony Siragusa was. But, to just, like, kind of have that, at least for his family, it's kind of nice to, like, be captured in film. So that was really sweet that, like, I do think I did enjoy that it celebrated, like, his life like that, and it is something they'll always have. And I might not rewatch it, you know, like Tim tonight, but I will go back and watch this at some point for sure.
If it's not tonight, like, this might be like a once a month viewing for me, like when I'm feeling sad. Or, you know, seasonal depression grips me, or
I used to throw in the Ravens 2000 America's Game when things
me too.
Things got bleak pre 2012.
Yeah, and Jace, the line, like you say, the Titans thing, like, and you cannot hear a sound, like when he's talking about that whole thing and the playbook stealing, which I love that they bring up, and they don't really hang on it here as much as they did in the 2001. And on that, I will say, look, I think Dilfer, I like Trent Dilfer, and maybe it's the Ravens bias coming out. I'd like him as an analyst. I think he's pretty good. He's full of himself, for sure, and now he's going to be a college head coach, and that's not going to go well, I don't think, but we'll see. But I do like listening to him. He's on Ryan Russillo's podcast a lot, and I think he's interesting, and he's one of these guys who, you know, commentators for me or analysts for me, if you can make, as a dork that I am, that I've literally – part of my personality is the National Football League at this point, which is something. Probably not healthy, but, you know, here we are. If a guy like that can teach me something, but also do it in layman's terms, where, like, no offense to him, he doesn't even know how to download podcasts, so he can't hear this. My dad can learn it as well. And we both learn something, and he demonstrates it in that way. That's an aside. I think Trent Dilfer is one of those guys. I liked how refreshing and, like, how honest he was during this entire thing of, like, he knew he wasn't very good, and like he knew he just had to do just enough, and you know, he was kind of like very upfront and honest with his guys about like, hey, we just need to make some plays, or we're screwing over this defense, what have you. And like, I don't know, I just, we've heard the Trent Dilfer stories, and we've heard, you know, and obviously the whole moving on to Elvis Gerback, whatever, and you know, did they let their Super Bowl winning quarterback go? You know, not a debate we need to have, but I thought he was good as well. He wasn't a star. He wasn't one of the big guys. But when they did that, and then they went to like the, you know, had to bench Tony Banks thing, and then they went to Trent Dilfer, I thought him both in the past clips as also the interviews as well, I thought he was really good. I thought he was, you know, it was refreshing not to hear him be like, oh yeah, well, I helped lead this team to the Super Bowl. He was like, no, I just had to do enough because I knew I wasn't that good, and I had already been, you know, kind of chewed up and spit out by the league at that point.
I loved the story he told about throwing the pick six in Tennessee and then leading them back on a subsequent touchdown drive. I had seen the interview that he gives at the end of that game. I'd seen it maybe in the NFL Films video where he starts to cry basically in that interview. And it kind of seems by itself, it was like, okay, NFL player is cries at the end of big game. But contrasting that against the story of him saying that was basically his career in a nutshell, was two drives. And the first drive is his ability. And the second drive is doing every single thing he can possibly do to be as good as he can possibly be with whatever limitations he has. And then hearing that and then seeing the interview with the two, you kind of like, it resonated way better about like, he's crying because he just saw his career flash in front of his eyes in the span of half of a quarter of a football game. And he ended up, you know, the order of it was interception, touchdown, not touchdown, interception. And he keeps the job and he leads the team to a Super Bowl. So yeah, that was it was great to see some more in things basically from Trent Dilfer. The playbook getting stolen, that was something else that had been said previously. Didn't know it was Greg frickin' Williams, who was the defensive coordinator of the Titans at the time. Told, who knows if this is even real, but according to Dilfer, admitted that he stole the playbook. And then would go on to lead Bountygate as the defensive coordinator of the New Orleans Saints 10 years later. So just Greg Williams, official NFL scumbag, confirmed. And, you know, good for him. And then the last thing I want to go over is just, the documentary ends, and it's, you turn it off, you say, wow, that was awesome. And then I just had like the sigh of sadness thinking, and they touched on it as well in the end, which, you know, that almost a cheap shot to Ravens fans was closing with how they didn't repeat, basically.
Yeah.
And it's just a sad sigh of thinking how legendarily talented that defense was and how they had some offensive pieces and should have competed for titles every year from, whatever, 2000 to 2006. They should have been the Chiefs of that era, where just every year, because they have Patrick Mahomes and Andy Reid, like, they're gonna be there, basically, in the final games of the season. That should have been this Ravens team for those 5-6 years. In my opinion, even with the hindsight of it not working out, the Dilfer to Gerback move was amazing, I think. Yeah. Even knowing that he was washed and over the hill at the time. But imagine that exact situation now, where a team wins a Super Bowl with that defense and that quarterback and that offense, and then they turn around and get a Gerback who was coming off of a Pro Bowl season, 4,000 yards in the air in the year 2000. He had a 2-to-1 touchdown ratio. This was the year before. This was not like it was 5 years ago, and then he had sort of been a middling guy since. He was coming off that, and the Ravens got him as the starting quarterback. And even with that, it just didn't work out. We get one title, and we have to live our stress for the next 10 years until they cap it at the end of Ray Lewis's career.
You know what killed me even more, Antonio, was obviously we knew the Gerback thing. I do think the Ravens may have underestimated Dilfer's kind of leadership capabilities or what he brought on that side. That's kind of what the doc sort of reminded me or showed me, if I had any takeaways from him on that. But the thing that really killed me was that Gerback, they mentioned, or at least Dilfer said this, so, you know, this is via his agent, so who knows how true any of this all is. But according to Dilfer, he was their third choice behind Gerback, who was their second choice, and Brad Johnson, who literally in 2002 game-managed his way to a Super Bowl victory, another two-time Pro Bowler. I was like, oh my god, this plan would have worked if they actually had gotten Brad Johnson instead of Elvis Gerback. I was like, they would have repeated in 2001, I think, because, they touched on it. The 2001 team went to the playoffs, made the divisional round. They went 10-6. They only had two less wins than the 2000 team. But it was just, you know, Gerback was old and over the hill, apparently, and committed too many mistakes. And that's what sunk them in the divisional round. I remember he threw three picks against the Steelers in the playoffs in a game. Pittsburgh had like 190 yards, and they beat us by like 17. You know, that was, you're right. I love the doc, but it was kind of just what might have been. I was like, if this stupid team gets Brad Johnson, not even that great a player, but like a Pro Bowl player, I was like, they probably win another one to two Super Bowls in the 2001 to, as you said, 4-6 range, because they went to the playoffs three times in that like four span and just were undone by bad quarterback play pretty much every time.
All right. I only have one more thing on this. Sorry. One more thing on this. I hope the New York Knicks and Philadelphia 76ers never win another game of basketball in their entire lives. I don't watch a ton of NBA, but I was reminded that there's a reason for that. That game had like 2 minutes and 15 seconds left for about 45 minutes. And I was screaming at the television to just end it. Like, the game was over and like every possession was a foul and or some stoppage of some sort. It's infuriating. I don't know why you people watch the NBA. The playoffs are fun, but most of these games don't matter. And we, as the collective, you know, the normal people who watch football and wanted football things, had to suffer through that for way too long. So those two teams can, yeah, they can go to hell.
They got to take some timeouts from these coaches. It's out of control.
Out of control.
Five to seven timeouts per half? That's far too many.
Tim, as someone who watches a bit of NBA, I don't think I've ever seen a regular season game where the team behind was like fouling. That's a college stuff. Like, that doesn't happen in the NBA. Once it's down like under a minute, they don't care. They just stop trying if they're down 10. They kept, because they knew we were going to watch Bullies of Baltimore, they were like, nah, we can do the fouling stuff when NBA foul shooters like don't get nervous because of the student section behind the basket. Like, they're going to just make the foul shot. Oh, it was infuriating. So that was it for the NBA in terms of Pod Like a Raven coverage. It was awesome. It was a great documentary. Perfectly timed in a week, as Tim mentioned, where there wasn't any real NFL. And perfect for us as Ravens fans. And I'm jacked up about the Super Bowl, which we will talk about as soon as we go over the random Raven. And Jace, you are up this week, so who do you have for us?
So for the astute watcher of the Bullies of Baltimore, you saw this player in passing, and I believe his name was mentioned one time, but certainly no one on the panel, so we'll dive into this. Clue number one: this player was drafted by the Ravens in the second round of the 1998 NFL draft. He spent the first 4 years of his career with the Ravens, and after bouncing around a few years, returned to the team in 2005. All told, he appeared in 45 games with 15 starts for Baltimore. Shockingly, this Olympic-caliber sprinter, as his Wikipedia entry called him, wasn't very productive for the Ravens. In five seasons, he caught just 60 balls for 929 yards and 7 touchdowns. He managed just one catch while suiting up in 4 playoff games for the Ravens, an 8-yard reception in Super Bowl 35. And then clue number 5, he wore 3 different numbers with the Ravens, 85, then most prominently number 83, and he wore number 11 in 2005.
Oh, God.
Some would call him, some being me, potentially the Ravens' first original wide receiver draft bust.
That took me... I think I'm right. That took me too long, though, if I am right, and that's why I'm concerned that I'm not right.
I have a name, right, but I thought... no, he's not on our random Raven list. Okay, so maybe...
I was shocked he wasn't. Honestly, I swore he's come up before, but maybe we just brought him up in passing.
Maybe.
All right, we will see. We will go over that at the end of the episode. Fantastic choice, I think. Jason,
yeah, I wanted to tie it into the 2000 Ravens. I thought this was a funny one.
All right. It's time. It's Super Bowl week, or as my brother-in-law sent me a spoof of, Superb Owl week. Don't get it twisted. It's the Super Bowl week. And it's the two best teams in the NFL playing each other. We deserve it, and we got it. It's the Kansas City Chiefs against the Philadelphia Eagles. Two teams with 14 wins. They scored like the same exact number of points or something like that. I saw some stat that came across where they basically had identical seasons. They're both the number one seed. They both won 14 games. They both had some sort of other numbers. Anyway, they're going to be evenly matched. It's, I think, what a lot of people are calling the best player against the best team. And that is Patrick Mahomes against the totality of the Philadelphia Eagles. Eagles currently 1.5 point favorites in this game. We're going to do a little bit of a preview, go through offense, defense stuff, and then jump into the more fun stuff, the prop bets and the final picks. Let's start, guys. Chiefs offense against Eagles defense. It's, an unstoppable force against an immovable object. Which one's going to happen? But the real issue is Patrick Mahomes healthy? I think he looked, healthy-ish in their conference championship. He has had two weeks to get as right as he can. So there's that aspect of this. And then it's the protection, protecting your maybe half-injured star quarterback. We talked about this a few other times with the Eagles. Led the NFL in sacks, got a bunch more in the postseason. They're scary along their defensive line. So where's the edge here? Between Mahomes, the Chiefs' offensive line, and the Eagles defensively being able to get enough pressure and just disrupt the Chiefs' flow on offense, a la their Super Bowl loss to the Bucks.
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest thing outside of all that other stuff you mentioned is in terms of quarterbacks, Eagles ain't played nobody. They've played Aaron Rodgers, who put up 33 on them in a loss, and they played Dak Prescott, who put up 40 on them in a win. And outside of that, the list is like Nathan Peterman, Andy Dalton, Danny Dimes a couple times, Cooper Rush, Heinicke, the corpse of Matt Ryan, Davis Mills, early Kenny Pickett back in October. This is Patrick Mahomes. And like, I know that they don't have a ton of receivers, but this is a completely different animal. Now, am I saying the Philly defense is overrated or bad? I don't think so. I think they're very, very good. I think Orlando Brown is going to have a horrendous time against Hassan Reddick or whoever they try and throw his way. Because guess what? He's not a good left tackle. And we all knew this. And he's not been very good for the I almost called him the St. Louis Cardinals. I don't know why I did that. The Kansas City Chiefs. This is weird. They both wear red. I still think that the Eagles defense will do enough on this side of the ball. Sort of a spoiler alert for one of my favorite props. I do think that they will get to the quarterback, and I think that they will get to the quarterback and pressure Mahomes a significant amount of times. Will they bring him down, though? Because Mahomes is slippery as an eel back there is a different question. So for me, it's the Eagles ain't played nobody in terms of the quarterback position. And then for the Chiefs, who's catching the ball? Like, Travis Kelce's Travis Kelce, don't get me wrong. And I don't think the Eagles have the strongest linebacking core, and I don't know how they're really going to go up against defending Travis Kelce. But, Mecole Hardman's on IR, like you mentioned. A couple guys made – was it MVS? Marquez Valdez-Scantling made some plays in the AFC Championship game, but could he do that again? Isaiah Pacheco's gotten to the point where, like, I wanted to put some Isaiah Pacheco props in there because he's just a fun player. Like, I love watching Pacheco play. He runs really, really mean, and he finishes off runs like a la like a Gus Edwards, just in a miniature version. But everybody's slobbering all over him, and that kind of worries me. Like, that player, here's your underrated player who's going to step up in the Super Bowl. I think Marcus Spears today called him the most important player in the Super Bowl.
This is what happens when you have 2 weeks to talk about again.
When you have 2 weeks to talk about stuff, but then that guy never produces, so that kind of worries me. Who's going to make plays for the Chiefs? The Eagles, it's not the best secondary, but there's players in that secondary. Darius Slay and what have you. I give the advantage, and I hate saying this, slightly to the Eagles' defense over the Chiefs' offense, to the point where I think they'll do enough to help try and win this football game.
So I'm very conflicted, and we'll make our official picks, and I don't think I'll waver, but I was all Chiefs. I was all Chiefs, and then you look more and more into it. This game, you know, it's the number one passing offense versus the Eagles. Actually, Tim, are the number one in defensive pass yards against per game. So, I think part of that is, like, you know, ball control. They just have the ball more, so it's like opportunities against. So I don't know what the yards per play breakdown is. That's just sort of overall, and I think that yards per play number is probably a lot lower. Because you're right, I don't think they have a ton of standouts, but they didn't have, I believe, C.J. Gardner-Johnson led the league in interceptions this year. Mm-hmm.
And teams are always throwing on them because they were down big.
Right, yeah, too. Exactly.
We've got to remember that.
So, yeah, so the stats actually suggest the Eagles, when Washington beat them, was being run on. And they're 16th against the run, so they're not as stout against the run. But are the Chiefs going to run the ball? That's like the thing Andy Reid hates. He hates to do it. And so, and you mentioned, I believe, Antonio, you mentioned Super Bowl 55. And that's kind of like the Chiefs offensive line certainly is a lot better than it was then. They've improved in major ways. Creed Humphrey's great. He obviously wasn't there when that game was played. They've improved their tackles. I think we're both missing in that game. I don't think Orlando Brown's great, but he's better than whoever super backup they had at the time. But conversely, I think this Eagles front is even better than that Buccaneers front was that gave them all those troubles. So, you know, it's an improved Chiefs line, but it's, I think, a better defensive line. And I believe Mahomes was hurting entering that game against the Buccaneers, and he still played really well, relatively, for a team that, you know, didn't score a touchdown, I guess. However, how well you could play at a 31-9 loss. But I have fears. I have real fears, I think, of the Eagles just getting after him real hard. And if he's not able to do it, but why in the end, I'll still pick the Chiefs, spoiler alert on my end, is I can't do it. I can't do it with Patrick Mahomes. I believe his ankle's going to be improved, and I just think, If he's this guy, if he's the best of his generation, I think he finds a way. I don't know. That's a dumb analysis. It's very simple. It's kind of hard to say just because we haven't seen, like, there's been very few updates about how his ankle actually is to this point, because, you know, they spend that first week kind of hunkered down in their own facilities and stuff. So there hasn't been a ton written about him to this point, but yeah, I don't know. It's just my faith in Mahomes. It's kind of that's kind of it. It's like, is he healthy? Then the Chiefs have a chance.
That offensive line in the Bucs game, Jace, was awful, and they knew they were awful, and they knew it was going to be a gigantic problem, and then it was a gigantic problem from the first snap to the last. They had one of the linemen they had, like, signed that week or something, or like 2 weeks before.
Yes,
one of the guys was
a
third stringer who hadn't played.
Had played for, like, a different team earlier in the playoffs, I think.
That was a disaster. And if anything, speaks to just how good Patrick Mahomes was that they went to the Super Bowl with that situation on the offensive line. I think that, like, haunts Andy Reid's nightmares to this day, just, you know, not having whatever the situation of that game. This line is much better than that. I agree that this Eagles front is probably better. However, I think overall that Bucs D was probably comparable to overall how this Eagles D is, and that kind of cancels things out. I think Andy Reid and Mahomes will have so many plays in the back pocket to offset an aggressive, good pass rush. There will be so many screens. There will be so many little, like, inside shovel toss, you know, shovel passes. Just, like, let them come and then dink stuff behind them and get them on their heels. I'm confident that we're going to see more of that than we did in that, you know, disaster with the Bucs. As for who makes plays, Tim, it's three catches for Smith-Schuster. It's four catches for Valdes-Scantling. It's two catches for Kadarius Toney, and then just everything else. I think it's just going to be spread out, and then everything else to Kelce, all the big stuff to Kelce. And that's how they've done every game this season, basically. You know, big workload for Kelsey and then spread things out to the other weapons. It's tough. It's tough because these teams are so freaking evenly matched and so talented. I guess I'd give, like, slight edge to the Eagles, but I'm just barely over the edge overall with, you know, overall talent on that side of the ball. Offensively for the Eagles against this Chiefs D that we know gives up the yards, they give up the points, and then they're always in games late, even though they can be porous at times. My question for this matchup, can Hurts make enough big throws to keep up with the Chiefs putting touchdowns on the board in this game? We've seen their offense, you know, be that well-oiled machine and everything in the system is working. But guess what? When you get to the Super Bowl, your quarterback is going to have to make three or four big-time throws. And he missed those previously in the playoffs. He's had some open guys that he has overthrown. He had the Devontae Smith wide open, but kind of a missed throw that Devontae Smith made a one-handed bounce catch off the ground to secure and to hang on to. Will he make enough of those big plays to win a Super Bowl when you really need to have him?
I don't know that he has to. I don't think there, like, I don't, not saying like I refute your question, but I don't think there's probably going to be one or two. And yeah, I think he's going to make those one or two, because he's playing a secondary that is much softer than what he played in San Francisco. And you're absolutely right. I mean, the Eagles offense was bad against the Niners. It was only easy because they were playing Josh Johnson and then a re-injured Brock Purdy, basically, who could do nothing but hand the ball off. And then the offense didn't really have to do anything, and they didn't really do anything. And I think Nick Sirianni knows that. I think he knows that they have to kind of be a bit, you know, more of that well-oiled machine that you're talking about. But I think they're going to be good enough in the run game where he doesn't have to necessarily make all the big plays. And then you know what? When he does, this is why you go get wide receivers. This is why, you know, at the end of the Ravens moratorium that we did, I threw my hand up and said I was wrong. That you can compete without having some of these guys. They went out and got A.J. Brown. They drafted Devontae Smith in the first round after missing on Jalen Reagor. Yeah, I know. Antonio is just sobbing into his hands right now.
They traded for him, Tim.
They traded for
A.J. Brown. It was just a first-round pick, and they got him.
All they had to do. And then they gave him the deal that he wanted, and it's worked out beautifully for them. And they've got Dallas Goedert over the middle, who is a good to great tight end. He's not, you know, he's not Kelsey. Kelsey's a Hall of Famer, but he's a serviceable guy. They have enough players out of the backfield where they can make plays if needed as well. And I just think that I think Hurts, first of all, is a supremely focused and professional guy. I think he knows that he needs to get better, and he's going to be better, and he's going up against the Chiefs secondary that, I don't know, man, everybody was sucking them off after the Bengals game because it was like, oh, Snead was out, and it was all these rookies. It was like three rookie cornerbacks, and they all stepped up big time. T. Higgins and Jamar Chase did okay, and there were multiple times, and we mentioned on this podcast here on Pod Like a Raven, where they just wouldn't jump. They just wouldn't jump for balls, and they just didn't really know how to play the position. I think Snead is back, but I think that there's enough of a talent disparity between the weapons that the Eagles have versus the weapon or the defensive talent that the Chiefs have, especially on the outside. I'm not talking about Chris Jones, because we'll get to him in a second. That Jalen Hurts doesn't need to be Superman. Patrick Mahomes has to be Superman for the Chiefs to win this football game. And he's more than capable of being Superman, Batman, and Green Lantern combined. But I think that Jalen Hurts just doesn't – he can't lose the game. He could win it if he wants to, but he doesn't have to win it. He just can't lose it. And I think, you know, spoiler alert, that's why I'm picking the Eagles, Mr. Evans.
I think you're right. Like, you probably want more yards. He's 154 and 121 in the playoffs, but again, they won 38-7 to 31-7. And now I certainly think I'm like talking myself into the Eagles as we go on and on here. But I certainly think it'll be.
Don't. I'm horrified. I'm terrified of my pick.
It'll certainly be closer, and I think he will have to hit a few more plays But you're right. That's why you have these stud receivers. I mean, AJ Brown was complaining about not getting the ball in that 38-7 win. These receivers are built different, as they say, and he has the ability to take over a game. I think you mentioned Chris Jones, but I think that's probably, for me, like where the big kind of matchup is in this game. Certainly when it comes to the Eagles offense, the KCDBs were really bad last week, but, they benefited from a decimated Bengals offensive line. Like the Bengals lost three of their four starters and the Chiefs took advantage. And I know the Eagles line's a little banged up, but it's the best in the NFL, I think, left or right. And I think that, matters. It's probably the position you want to be best on your team. If you have a good offensive line, like you said, Tim, you can win without having your quarterback to have to, throw for 400 yards. Like if your offensive line's great, it just opens up so many possibilities. And certainly I think the two more weeks of rest will benefit Hurts. He's admitted he's not 100% or wasn't. So, I think he'll be better. He really didn't hit the deep ball against the Giants or the Niners. Which he kind of excelled at all season. But I think it'll come down to just that offensive line. If they can just keep him upright and they play mistake-free, it is going to be tough, I think, on the Chiefs' defense.
There is a scenario in this game where A.J. Brown has the 9-catch, 150 yards, where most of the catches were not even deep throws, and he just breaks 6 to 8. Tackles, as we have seen the Chiefs give up defensively in a variety of moments.
We've seen AJ Brown do as Ravens fans.
Oh no, Chase. Intangibles, guys, and this is the one thing that tilts so far the other direction in favor of the Chiefs: the experience versus the youth, the Andy Reid versus Sirianni. You have a quarterback who's been there. He's won it and he's lost it. You got a whole core that's done that. You have Andy Reid, who's been everywhere, done everything, been with the Eagles. I don't think that impacts anything in terms of handicapping or what's actually going to happen in this game. But at what point in the second quarter, when the going gets tough, do the Chiefs breathe and the Eagles panic, or Sirianni strays from the script, or Hurts is put in a situation that he's never been in before, whereas the Chiefs can just sort of say, we saw this, we know it, we have time, the halftime show is going to be 45 minutes long, we have time to regroup and figure stuff out. We know the difference of experience. How big of a factor do you think that will be or can be in a game like this? Or is it just, we're just doing the pregame talk, we've had 2 weeks to talk about it, guess what? The best team on the field wins, not the most experienced team.
I think the coaching might matter. It's weird with Andy Reid, though, because like he's almost 25 years into being a head coach and still will just make head scratching. Like he's going to do a head scratching timeout or take a timeout to then like set up a field goal attempt when he from 5 yards away. He'll do weird stuff. Like that's just part of the Andy Reid thing. But they don't play a ton. But I did look just the last five meetings. Of the Eagles and Chiefs, and the winning coach in all five meetings was Andy Reid. 3 times with the Eagles, 2 times with the Chiefs, and that tells me Andy Reid's a good coach. He's one of the best in NFL history. He has the second most playoff wins all time, behind only Bill Belichick. Nick Sirianni, this is only his second year as a head coach. So I think if there is an experience thing, it's with the head coaches, I would think. Because, there's still a fair amount of Eagles who were there in 2017, especially in the key leadership positions. Jason Kelsey and Lane Johnson on the offensive line. Brandon Graham, he forced basically the game-winning fumble on Tom Brady in that Super Bowl. Fletcher Cox.
Oh, the best.
They have still some guys, some dudes who have been with the Eagles a very long time, including back when Andy Reid drafted some of those guys. I don't think the players it'll matter as much. Like Jalen Hurts played in big games in college. Certainly it's a bigger deal than the Super Bowl. But Tim mentioned he seems like one of the most like professional, like serious guys of the young quarterbacks in the league. He's the son of a coach. He takes it very, very, very seriously. So I don't think he'll be overwhelmed, but I do think it is a little different. Like Jalen Hurts, I've been impressed with him. I didn't expect him to ever be this good in the NFL when he was in college. But I think it's just a different game when it's him versus Patrick Mahomes. For me, that's kind of what the whole matchup comes down to. It's the best quarterback in the league, best player in the league. I think some would argue the most talented player of all time when it comes to quarterback and Patrick Mahomes, and certainly a guy who's kind of brandishing his legend and seems like a great leader too. So I think the quarterback matchup's the big thing, obviously, but I will be interested to see. Sirianni seems like he can kind of be a bit of a hothead, some of the things he says and does on the sidelines. So I wonder if it gets tight, if he gets tight. The Eagles have kind of had a pretty easy run of it, as Tim sort of laid out with the quarterbacks. And just, it's very rare we get to the Super Bowl and a team's been this not challenged in the playoffs. You know, 38-7, 31-7. It might just mean they're spectacular and are about to beat the Chiefs by 24. But it also, you know, could be like you've had it too easy. And the Chiefs have had this Mahomes injury and they had to grind against the Jaguars. And you know, they had to grind against the Bengals. And who knows? So, I don't know. I think I give edge to Andy Reid just because I like Andy Reid, but the rest I think is all kind of a wait and see. But if Mahomes is Mahomes, for me that's kind of the ultimate intangible. If he's back to being 100%, he's the best player in the game, and I think he can pull it off for him.
I don't have to much to add. I will say we should just emphasize the point of Andy Reid. See, I have a sneeze coming up. Andy Reid. Oh, it's coming. Sorry. Sorry, podcast listeners. I'm trying not to blast your ears off with it with a sneeze. I think it's gone away. I think Andy Reid could make a monumental screw up because he's a great coach, but it's happened more than it should. They're up by 4 and it's like 2:45 left in the fourth quarter and he throws the ball 3 times and all of a sudden the Eagles have the ball before the two-minute warning with all their timeouts because they didn't have to waste any because Andy Reid wanted to throw the ball. There's, let's do the circle huddle play where we all dance around in a circle like the ring around the rosy and then do something crazy. Let's
little first quarter hook and lateral, Tim?
Absolutely try the little first quarter hook and lateral. Like, and he's a great coach, but that would scare me to no end. From the same token, Sirianni – Sirianni's going to go into this game being like, I am not punting, I refuse. Like, 4th and 15 for my own 5, and I'm going to try and go for it. And that, I think one of these coaches, again, much like Jalen Hurts, could lose this game rather than win it based on some decisions they make. I think that's an intangible there. I think the other intangible, and, you know, I'm happy for you guys to say this is just a personal one for you, and you're wrong about this. I think that the Chiefs expended a lot of energy getting to this point. And I know Jay said, well, they're battle tested and what have you, and that's great, and they've been here before, and I understand that. But Mahomes is not healthy. Jalen Hurts is not healthy either, we should mention. He even said, like, I don't feel 100%, which is certainly a point. But there's something to be said for your emotional Super Bowl that you then can't recover from. You know, look at it's a little bit of a different situation, but look at the Bills. The Bills almost expended too much energy against the Bengals and were too hyped up and you know, all, like, over-focused, and then they end up just losing it because the Bengals came in more prepared, what have you. I think it's not as far as saying that the Chiefs already won their Super Bowl because obviously they're Super Bowl champions. They know what it takes to get here. But they heard everybody, and I mean everybody, picking the Bengals to win the Super Bowl. They heard that, and they came out with a vengeance and won that football game. I almost wonder from an emotional standpoint, and again, this is lessened because this team has been here before. If it was flipped and it was the Eagles, I'd say this is a big disadvantage. That they've almost won their big game already, if that makes sense. And I know it's, you know, you could spit in my face and go, no, you just wanted them to beat the Bengals so bad that now you're spit.
It was your big game.
Which, you know what? You're right. You're 100% right.
I cared about who won that game.
And I can't. And this one, I literally don't care. You know, I've already said it. I'm picking the Eagles, but I literally don't care if the Chiefs win this game because, you know, I don't like the Chiefs as an AFC person, but they don't necessarily bother me. And I like Andy Reid. And, you know, I can't like Patrick Mahomes because he's obsessed with ketchup, but that's my own personal battle. That is the other intangible for me. Do the Chiefs come in and, or do the Chiefs do the Chiefs thing where it's like, oh no, they're down 14. Oh, don't worry, we'll come back. And the Eagles are like, no, we're just going to step on your throat now because we have this dominant team that can do it and likes to control the ball and doesn't get too cute and will keep it simple for the amount of time that they need to keep it simple. That, for me, is again, another intangible as well. The only other thing I should mention, because we haven't mentioned him yet, Jason Kelce might be the best center of all time. If anybody's going to handle Chris Jones, if anybody is, and I'm not saying he is, if anybody's going to handle Chris Jones, it's Jason Kelce. So that might be an advantage as well. Or, you know, unless the Chiefs completely keep him away from Jason Kelce, which I could also see.
I think the slow start stuff is more likely to happen to Philly than it is the Chiefs, just because they've been there, they've done it, they know how important whatever the start of the game is. I don't envision a Patrick Mahomes led whatever unit, blah blah blah, to like be unprepared for the moment, for the start, for some slow things to happen. I think they're gonna have that under control, and the Super Bowl and the conference championship thing, if they played on a Sunday and the Super Bowl was the next Saturday, I would say yes. But 2 full weeks of prep, I think they're beyond. I think they took a week to like get right and rest and breathe and relax. And then the next whole week is, here's what we play for. Here's what Patrick Mahomes wants to do. I've said his name 1,000 times. It is annoying, but he's proven it over and over and over and over again. So he will be ready. I do not if they come out and they're down 14 to start, it's because the Eagles are just really that good. And they're whatever. They have a long drive offensively, and they're just better in terms of a matchup offensively against the Chiefs D, as opposed to just this sluggish start based on the, you know, the weeks before.
Andy Reid also legendarily great after byes. That's something I hadn't thought about, Antonio. Entering the playoffs, he was 27-4 off a bye. So an extra week to prepare, certainly a good thing for an Andy Reid team.
Yeah, it's so close, guys. It's so close. I haven't said my pick yet because I'm like gonna cheat with the pick. I'll save that maybe for the end. We can do our official picks for the end. Let's jump into prop bets, guys. Let's do the fun stuff here. We each compiled a list of some of our best bets here. Some of our fun stuff. Some of our potential big winners. And we're just going to go around in a circle, I suppose. I'll start, and then we'll go to Jace next, and then to Tim. And we're going to pick one, and then, you know, so you could, at risk of stealing each other's picks, we'll do one each and then go around and agree or disagree or tell the listener, that's dumb, listener. Don't listen to what he said, even though we rarely do that here. And I am going to jump just right in off the top rope. And it's my biggest, let me see if I'm doing this right. It's my biggest bet, my biggest odds bet. And it's MVP. And I'm coming in so spicy because last year, I just want to remind the listener, I had a fantastic Super Bowl last year with prop bets, with the game pick. I think I went 5-1, 4-1, something like that, including the MVP pick where I picked Cooper Kupp as opposed to one of the quarterbacks. And guess what, guys? There is no such thing as too much of a good thing. I'm double dipping. I'm off the quarterbacks. I'm going Travis Kelce for MVP of the Super Bowl.
Not a chance.
Ladies and gentlemen, he is plus 1,600 to win the Super Bowl MVP. That means you bet 100, you win $1,600. And here's my pitch to you. He had 110 catches this year, the most of his career. He had 1,338 receiving yards, the second most of his career. He had 12 receiving touchdowns, the most of his career. He was a first-team All-Pro. He has cemented this legacy as one of the best ever at the position. In the playoffs, he had 21 catches and 3 touchdowns and 176 receiving yards in 2 games. Didn't play the third game. And I know what you're thinking. Antonio, this is the MVP of the Super Bowl. You're reading off his statistics from the regular season. That matters. In my opinion, the regular season matters in terms of creating the narrative for who should win the MVP if they have a good game. Cooper Kupp had this ridiculous wide receiver season, came into the Super Bowl with that narrative. Guess what his line was in the game? 8 catches, 92 yards, and 2 touchdowns. Didn't have double-digit catches, didn't have 100 yards receiving. He had 2 touchdowns, he won Super Bowl MVP. if Travis Kelce has a 12 catch, 150 yard, 2 touchdown game, which is basically what he's averaged over the last couple of weeks, he will legitimately be in play to win MVP of the Super Bowl based on this narrative of he's been that guy, he's jumped a tier, whatever. He's one of the best tight ends ever, if not the best. He's going to fight it out with Gronkowski, I guess. He had the amazing playoff stretch, including that, you know, for the 14 catch game. He had all the sound bites after they beat the Bengals. He was the guy on stage with all the great quotes. People remember that. If he has a dominant game and catches multiple touchdowns and they win, he's going to at least be in the conversation for MVP, and I'd rather be taken plus 1,600 than just go, it's more fun, whatever. Yeah, the quarterbacks win it a lot. I think it's more fun at this number. That could legitimately happen. And I'm going to add one other small thing here. What if Mahomes tweaks his ankle and misses another few drives, misses a quarter, same exact thing happens, and Henny comes in? Who do you think he's going to throw the ball to? It's going to be Travis Kelce. It's going to be the, ooh, remember that drive where it was just Henny to Kelce, Henny to Kelce, and then Patrick Mahomes came running back onto the field and they were able to close it out. I think this is a sweet number at plus 1,600. I think it's more fun than taking the quarterbacks. And I don't, you know, I'm going to stop there. I was going to go into the Eagles, some of the Eagles options, but I'm going to stop there with Travis Kelce, Super Bowl MVP. And Patrick Mahomes is behind him, giving the applause, like, oh, he loves his guy. Yeah, he should have had one of these two.
Antonio, Travis Kelce, MVP, my number one pick of all the long shot non-quarterback MVPs. I think if it's not, Tim, if it's not Hurts, if the Eagles win, and if it's not Mahomes, if you think the Chiefs are going to win the Super Bowl, you should absolutely bet Patrick Mahomes. I saw the number plus 130 for MVP. It's very likely to happen if the Chiefs win. But there's a world, like Antonio laid out. And I see it. And we talked earlier about who are they going to have to funnel the ball to.
You better hurry up with this point or I'm going to talk over you.
Who are they going to have to funnel the ball to? It's Travis Kelce. I see it, man. I could see it happening. And all you need is like two interceptions. You need Mahomes to uncork a pick or two. And that's all the voters need to do it. But bouncing off his point, if you're like me, of the belief that Travis Kelce is going to have a big game, I'm not saying he's going to win MVP. I'm just saying it's my fun top long shot. Some fun Travis Kelce props that caught my eye. Travis Kelce to score 2 TDs, I saw on Vegas Insider via FanDuel listed at plus 450. He has minus odds for any time TD, but 2 TDs plus 450. And then Kelce plus 700 for game's first TD. I loved both of these. If you're of the mind that Travis Kelce's going to get the ball a lot, and if he is going to be on a potential Super Bowl MVP track, he's going to probably score early. He's probably going to score multiple times. So kind of just pivoting off Antonio's point, I love those two Kelce props, because especially the 2-TD one. The minus odds for any time TD, where's the fun in that? But 2 TDs, come on now. Now you have me intrigued.
All right, I'll just go first with my first prop bet because it is a Kelce-related one, and it's more boring. It's obviously more boring. Travis Kelce, 25-plus receiving yards in each half, is minus 145. It was minus 120, and then everybody hammered it. I got it late. Minus 145. I know it's not the best payout, but I agree with all of this. I also agree that plus 1,600 is tempting, and it's fun. But there is no world where the Chiefs win the Super Bowl and Patrick Mahomes is not named the MVP. Let's go through a couple things here to refute some of the things that you guys said. If Patrick Mahomes misses a quarter of this football game, the Chiefs are not winning the Super Bowl. Chad Henne cannot touch the field for the Chiefs to win this Super Bowl against the Philadelphia Eagles.
Tim, these are good points.
Let's go to the next point. My other biggest thing here. Antonio is absolutely right when he says, well, it's the Super Bowl MVP. No. People think about the storyline. They think about the storyline, and I agree with all the Travis Kelce stuff that Antonio laid out. But that was a lot of numbers. That was a lot of, like, ooh, there was a lot of little, like, math. Like, you know, Matthew McConaughey and Wolf of Wall Street. A lot of, you know, above the shoulders type of stuff. Like, very acidic, all numbery. You know what's easy for writers and easy for the voters? Best player in the NFL, bum ankle lead Super Bowl win. That's going to be the story. He's going to be limping around there, throwing every pass to Travis Kelce. I'm more than willing to accept that. 14 catches, you know, 150 yards, two tuds. I'm more than willing to accept that. But they're going to look at Mahomes and go, oh, look at the grit on Patrick Mahomes. And if they win the Super Bowl, he's going to be on the field the entire time. He's going to play incredibly well, I think. And they're going to give him the MVP because it's a boring award. And I don't disagree that it probably should be Kelce if he goes off for that. But it's just not going to be. So I love, again, 1,600, why not? Have a little Sprinky. If we get to, like, you know, 627 on Sunday and I'm starting to get really nervous about my Eagles pick, I'll just, you know, maybe I'll throw some on that because Antonio, again, had a very, very good Super Bowl last year and he's a very smart gambler. I just, this one, I don't think there's any chance. If you're gonna go non-quarterback, I would go Eagles options. And I don't have them in front of me. I didn't look at Super Bowl MVP. But if you're gonna go non-quarterback and you're stuck to that, go Eagles options because I think Hurts can game manage the hell out of this game and win. Patrick Mahomes has to be the Chiefs for the Chiefs to win the Super Bowl. So I think it's automatic that he, you know, if you're picking the Chiefs, just go Chiefs money line and Patrick Mahomes Super Bowl MVP in a parlay, and that'll be it.
Yeah, I mean, not likely to happen.
That's why it's plus 1600. I know.
But I'm tempted. That number is just so good.
Fair enough.
And Jace, I think Jace makes maybe the better point than the injury is, does Mahomes throw two picks in this game? That may impact. And Kelce has the ridiculous game. That's basically what happened to Stafford. He had some turnovers in
Stafford
their game, and that all but eliminated him as any sort of, you know, the quarterback of the winning team, winning MVP. All right, my second one is my second longest shot pick. Whatever, we're doing them in order. And Jace likes Travis Kelce for first touchdown of the game. I don't hate that. I don't hate that, Jace. I'm going Eagles. I'm going Miles Sanders. First touchdown. It's plus 850. It's another tasty number where you don't have to put a lot down and you can win a lot. And I'm just repeating the script from the 49ers game, basically. The toss goes, whatever. The Eagles get the ball first and they just come out with that perfect, you know, just set up list of plays. They got the 10-15 plays that they had all set to go entering the game and they run them effectively. The Chiefs D are on their heels. And they drive down the field, they get inside the 10-yard line, and they hand it off to Miles Sanders, and he has a 6-yard carry for a touchdown. That's what they did against the amazing defense of the 49ers on the first drive, and they can do it again against a much worse Chiefs defense, and it's plus 850 for the starting running back in a Super Bowl. Sirianni probably not going to have Hurts just slinging the ball all over the field on the first drive of the game. It'll probably be a lot of just the short passes, stuff on the ground, and when they get in the red zone, give it to Sanders and go behind that offensive line. Even if the Chiefs get the ball first, can't you see a scenario where the Chiefs get a couple of first downs and then the drive stalls, they kick a field goal, maybe the Eagles get a sack in the red zone and they have to settle for a field goal, and then you just give the ball to the Eagles and the same exact drive happens, even though they didn't get the ball first. I'm into this. Miles Sanders, first touchdown, plus 850.
I like that pick a lot, Antonio, but I am looking for my next prop, not at the Eagles starting running back, but their backup running back, Kenneth Gainwell, most rushing yards in a game, plus 550. He was the Eagles' leading rusher in both playoff games against the Giants and against the 49ers. And he's just
mop-up duty, Jace. It was mop-up duty.
Oh, am I being contradictory in my picks? Maybe. But he looked real good. He looked like he had the stuff that maybe Sanders didn't, the little pop. So, I don't know. I got suckered in by the Gainwell experience, and I saw that number, and I was like, Miles Sanders plus 165, most rushing yards in the game. That's not exciting. I was like, Jalen Hurts plus 350. He hasn't been running a ton since his injury, so I couldn't trust that. But Kenneth Gainwell, yeah. Now you have my interest. So that is my second prop. A little bit of a goofy one, but one that caught my eye for sure.
I swear to God we did not talk about these beforehand. Yes. But I have a kind of a double combo prop. Two props here that both involve Kenneth Gainwell. we'll start with Kenneth Gainwell over 18.5 rushing yards in the game.
Oh.
That's it.
Lock.
If you look, he is currently in the regular season. He averaged 4.4 yards an attempt. Let's go. Yeah, I'm looking at actually, there's a little bit of a spoiler there. Yeah, 4.4 yards an attempt. In the playoffs, he's averaging 6.2 yards per attempt. If you even take the 4.4, just that, he needs a total of 5 carries to hit his average, and he's got 22 yards. He's slamming the over there. This one's at minus 114. He's, again, like we all said, I know mop-up duty. He's gone over 18.5 yards, including playoffs. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 times this season. 9 times. They give him the ball as well. You know, he's in the play, in the 2 playoffs games, he's averaged 13 carries per game. You know, in the regular season, I know it was a little bit less, obviously, but I think Kenneth Gainwell, over 18.5 yards at minus 114 is a lock, and that moves me to a plus odds here prop. Kenneth Gainwell to have more rushing yards than Jerick McKinnon at plus 100. Plus 100. So let me just roll this through you. We did all the Kenneth Gainwell stats, right? Since the game against Houston on December 18th, where Jerick McKinnon had 10 rushing attempts for 52 yards, he has had 5 attempts for 7 yards against the Seahawks, 2 attempts for 4 yards against the Denver Broncos, 2 attempts for 6 yards at the Las Vegas Raiders, 11 attempts for 25 yards, averaging 2.2 yards per carry against the Jacksonville Jaguars, and then last week, 4 attempts for 1 yard. They know that he is the receiving running back. They love giving him the little screen pass, the little shovel pass. Those don't count as rushing yards, folks. Those counted as receiving yards. Kenneth Gainwell, more rushing yards than Jerick McKinnon, I almost said Pacheco, at plus money, at plus 100. That's stealing from FanDuel. I mean, it's too good to be true.
I love that pick.
Oh, when Kenneth Gainwell is, like, inactive for this game, it's just going to be a real...
Oh, I'm done.
He only got carries because they were up by 30 points in both playoff games. I love it, run with the ball, quite literally, but I have some concerns. I like the over the yards, Tim's yards one. That I'm definitely... Was it 18?
18.5. So it was 16.5. Yeah. People jumped on it. It's now 18.5. And all it takes is like one run and then a couple short yard attempts. That's all it takes. Yeah. And they rotate running backs too. And Jalen Hurts, as Jace mentioned, isn't running as much with the injury. Kenneth Gainwell's going to get carries in this game. All it takes is him to get over 18.5. Bust one and we're done. Bust one and we're done. Family show.
All right. Let's go next. I'm up, right? Is it back to me?
Yes.
Here?
Yeah, back to you.
Whatever. My least fun one. Travis Kelce over 79.5 receiving yards. It's even money. If they win, he'll be the reason they won, and he'll have 80 or more yards receiving. If they are losing and lose, he will have a ton of fourth quarter usage. Unless the Eagles quite literally have two humans covering him on every play, he's going to get over 80 yards. He's going to be the... like the engine for the passing game. I'm just taking it, and considering how much I like him as a long shot for MVP, I think he's going to at least get 80 yards receiving. Finn.
It's hard to argue. I'm also sticking with the Chiefs for my next one. I love plus money odds, if you guys haven't noticed, for these props. Frank Clark to record a sack, plus 124. Frank Clark, not a great guy, generally an inconsistent player, but he is incredible in the playoffs. He has sacks in both of the Chiefs playoff games this year, and in fact, Frank Clark is third all-time on the NFL's official list for playoff sacks, which is since 1982, when they started counting sacks. He's behind Bruce Smith and the leader, Willie McGinnis, and then it's Frank Clark at number three. He comes alive in the playoffs, and to get plus odds on a guy who has a sack in every game this year... I know I said the Eagles' line's very good, so they might not get many opportunities, certainly. But I don't know. I just like the Frank Clark at plus money, guy who gets seemingly gets a sack in every playoff game he plays. So that was one that caught my eye as well.
I have a couple sack ones that I'll run through at the end when we do and like just rattle them off, because I know obviously we're going long here because we're talking about prop bets. But my last one that I'll just expand on a little bit, and it's probably not my most confident one, I will say, but this one's fun, and I do want to see what you guys think of this one, because I didn't want to include it in my rattle off. Last play of the game to be a quarterback kneel. No, at plus 184. I think this game is going to be close. It will not be. The last play will not be a quarterback kneel at plus 184. I don't have the yes for you, unfortunately. I was trying to pull that up real quick, and it's not there. I think, obviously, like Jay said, it is the underdog side. I know that the yes was a minus sign, and we love hunting for plus signs here, obviously, as you know. I think this game is going to be close enough to the point that all it takes is the team losing to have the ball last. And I think that's a very good chance that we get some weird lateral play or some like Hail Mary at the very end of the game with the team down two. And it's not going to be just a simple let's kneel it out. Now, where this could turn is Mahomes or Hurts throwing a pick with 14 seconds left and the guy, you know, just dives on the ground and then you QB kneel it from there. That could kill me, I know, but something about this game, and maybe we're hyping it up too much, I just think there's going to be something on the line with that last play of the game.
No, I like that. I mean, it's a way to root for just general excitement too, which is always fun.
Sure.
I'm very excited for the Super Bowl. The more closer we get to it, 1-1, I don't really care who, for the first time in a long time, I don't really care who wins. I feel like, you know, Tom Brady's not involved, hopefully ever again. It's just, should be a fantastic game. I'm really looking forward to it.
All right, I have two picks left, so I'm going to say them both here, and then we can have you guys get your final picks. I know Tim and I are in agreement about this one. We had a little pre-show chat by accident, and Tim, let's run with it. It's over 5.5 sacks for the game total.
Ooh,
between both teams.
Combo.
It's plus 104. It's not that much plus money, but it's not minus money. It's plus money for over 5.5 sacks. Patrick Mahomes, mobility. Could very easily limit him against the Eagles team that led the league in sacks by a mile and then got a bunch in the postseason. We need 2 sacks from the Chiefs defense, maybe, who, as we have touched on, have Chris Jones off the playoff sack schneid. You know, he's ready to go now. Frank Clark could steal a sack or two, and then Jace will hit something there. Chiefs-Bengals had 8 sacks total. Eagles-Niners had 4, but it was a blowout with backups in the fourth quarter, and the 49ers, who were behind and throwing, basically were doing 3-step drop, 5-yard passes the entire second half because Brock Purdy couldn't feel his hand and could not throw the ball or take 5-step, 7-step drops, that kind of thing. So, boy, I think the Eagles get 4 sacks. I think the Chiefs get 2. And we have 6 sacks halfway through the fourth quarter. I'm very into this over 5.5 sacks. And then quickly, this is just my just like a fun one. I don't know if I'm going to touch it or not, but I'll laugh if it happens. Either team misses a point after touchdown.
No,
it's plus 300, fellas. Plus 300. Jake Elliott missed 2 extra points this year. Butker missed 3 this year. 1 could get blocked. We could have a penalty after a touchdown, an excessive celebration. Maybe Mahomes throws a touchdown and has another penalty or something. A taunting penalty happens. And all of a sudden, the point after becomes a 45-yard attempt. That could get missed. So I'm very intrigued by a plus 300. Either team has to miss the point after touchdown.
That's extremely fun. Tim, I'll let you go quick. The only thing I have is a few more of the MVPs that caught my eye, and we've talked about them a little bit. Obviously, A.J. Brown, plus 1,300 is what I saw as Super Bowl MVP. If you're in on the Eagles and don't think it's going to be Jalen Hurts, I think that's intriguing. A one that even intrigued me even more, based on what we saw against a pretty decent Niners offensive line in the NFC title game, Hassan Reddick at plus 3,000. As Super Bowl MVP. Now, a defensive player has not won Super Bowl MVP since Von Miller did in Super Bowl 50, and you'd have to put up a kind of commensurate line, I think, with what he did, which was 2.5 sacks, 2 forced fumbles, that one directly was a defensive touchdown by his team, and the other led to offensive touchdown in a 24-10 win. So maybe there won't be enough scoring to justify it.
And your quarterback also has to be essentially a senior citizen.
Yeah,
at that point,
a guy who has a severe neck injury who can't throw the ball more than 5 yards. So it's less likely than that scenario that played out. But I think like what we saw like Reddick do last week, if he could kind of do what he did in the first half, like over the course of a full game, like multiple game-changing sacks, strip sack, fumble recovery, he could maybe compile enough stats to sort of get in it. But the AJ Brown one caught my eye, and then that's for hit defensive players the most intriguing. And I know these teams, at least the Eagles, love to run. Don't bet anything on an MVP running back. A running back has not won Super Bowl MVP since 1998. So save your money there, people.
Good call. I will say, I said it here before, and no free ads, but I do use FanDuel. Their Super Bowl props thing is kind of annoying because you pull up the Super Bowl props page, and then you go to more Super Bowl bets, and it takes you to the main Super Bowl page, not the props page, and then you can't find the props unless you like had them at that time. All I'm saying is I was really trying to bet that kicker to miss an extra point, and I can't find it, and I really need that on my sheet here before this episode comes out and it moves the line because everybody slams it. A couple more that I have real quickly. To go along, I'm with Antonio on the 5.5 sacks. To kind of hedge my Eagles pick, Chris Jones to record a sack and the Chiefs to win the Super Bowl plus 240. Again, you know, he doesn't get a sack in the postseason. He had two in the biggest game against the Bengals. Maybe he just keeps the hot streak going. We did the Travis Kelce one here. Chris Jones over 3.5 tackles. That includes assisted tackles as well. Now, I looked at his stats this year, and I'm not super confident about this one anymore. He's a game record that doesn't get a lot of tackles. Hopefully that changes here, although I know it's tough against that Eagles team. Yes, both teams to complete their first pass attempt at minus 105. I think rhythm. They're going to get Jalen Hurts in rhythm. They'll get Patrick Mahomes in rhythm, unless Andy Reid does something ridiculous, which could also happen too. Don't love the minus odds there, but, you know, what are you going to do? And then my last one that I haven't mentioned here, because we did all the Gainwell stuff, is heads at minus 104 for the coin toss. I'm going heads. Everybody says tails never fails. Even before listening to the Bill Simmons podcast today, they said heads was like 7 out of the last 10 Super Bowls or something like that. Even before I heard that, I went heads. I'm always a heads guy anyway. Another family show, Jesus. I think that team is going to, or that team, I think heads is going to win. So give me heads minus 104.
Yeah, tails never fails. That fails about 50% of the time, roughly.
Yeah, exactly.
Right about half. All right, last picks here. The game itself. My co-hosts are, you know, men and made actual picks for the game against the line. And I'm afraid of it. So I'm going to instead do a two-team parlay. There's only one game, but a two-bet parlay. Because I think two things are going to happen in this game. I think it's going to be close. I don't know who's going to win. And I think there's going to be points scored. The Chiefs, number one in terms of scoring points. The Eagles, number three in terms of scoring points. I think the Chiefs are at 29 points per game, and the Eagles are at like 27 points per game. So anyway, I'm doing two lines adjusted by 6 points. I'm going to take the Chiefs plus 7.5. I'm taking them because they're 1.5-point dogs, so I'm getting the extra 1.5 point, and I'm moving it, you know, the 6 points to plus 7.5. And then I'm taking the over, but I'm adjusting the line from 50.5 to 44.5. So it has to be a one-score game, basically, and you got to get 45 points. Both of these teams love going for it on fourth down. They're not going to kick field goals on fourth and one, fourth and inches. They're not going to punt at midfield on fourth and two. They're going to be aggressive, and even if that aggression works half the time overall, That good old math tells me that that's going to benefit the points. It's going to benefit the over. And I think we have like a 30-27 game either way. 28-27, something close like that. Chiefs, plus 7.5. In addition to over 44.5. One bet. Two things need to happen. I'm 37-27 on the season. I would love to finish the season at up, you know, plus double digits here. I don't want to be up nine units. I want to be up 11. So that's the final bet. And that's it. Now to my fellows who have real, honest bets on the actual line of this game.
Yeah, and we're on both sides of the fence, Tim. Do you want me to just go first and you can argue the opposite side?
Yeah, I'm currently putting in Miles Sanders to score the first and last TD at plus 8,000. So, yeah, go ahead.
So I'm taking the Chiefs still. So I saw this via ESPN reading some of their gambling coverage. The Chiefs, 8-11 against the spread this season. Don't cover a lot. They are the sixth team to reach the Super Bowl with a losing record against the spread, and four of the previous five teams of those six to reach the Super Bowl with a losing ATS record lost the Super Bowl. But Patrick Mahomes is an underdog. It seems like he's going to be an underdog, unless the money really gets moving, for just the 10th time in his career in this game, and it'll be the first time he's an underdog in the playoffs at kick, if it line stays. He's 6-3 outright as an underdog, and if I believe Patrick Mahomes is healthy and the best player in the NFL, and one of the best quarterbacks of all time, which I'm led to believe is probably true to this point, I think he finds a way to win this game. I just don't want to bet against him as an underdog. It's kind of all the pick comes down to, and that is why my pick is Chiefs plus 1.5. Plus 1.5. But as the days have gone by and we get closer to the Super Bowl, I lean more and more towards the Eagles. So take that for what you will. But the pick officially is Chiefs plus 1.5, just because I can't bet against Mahomes.
I don't like that as of right now, 77% of the money is on the Eagles. 71% of the bets is on the Eagles. I don't like being on that side. I loved being on the non-Bengals side last week, even just from a picks perspective, because it was like everybody was just punching their ticket. I don't love this whole Eagles, like, team of destiny type of thing all year, and, like, now they think that they're the underdogs when they're not. It sounds a lot like the Cincinnati Bengals last week. I'm picking the Eagles. I think the Eagles are just better. If Patrick Mahomes was healthy, I'd have a worse time with this. Part of it is because I did put a small future on the Eagles and now just want to not hedge and just go for it. I will admit to my bias is there. I just think overall they are better. They are just a better football team than this Chiefs team who has a lot of top-level talent, but I'm not sure about the middle and lower tiers. And I hate betting against Patrick Mahomes. Again, I'm happy that I'm not actively, like, with my guts and emotion rooting for a team here. You know, I'm slightly going to favor the Eagles, monetarily, of course. But I just think it comes down to this. I know, we ain't played nobody. That's not their fault. And even when they hadn't played nobody, they beat the crap out of the teams they're supposed to beat the crap out of for the most part. So give me Philly and grease up the light poles, baby. Eagles win this one.
All right, Jace, let's go over the random Raven one more time and get on out of here.
Yes, so clue number one. This player was drafted by the Ravens in the second round of the 1998 NFL Draft. Number two, he spent the first 4 years of his career with the Ravens and, after bouncing around a few years, returned to the team in 2005. All told, he appeared in 45 games for the Ravens with 15 starts. Shockingly, this Olympic-caliber sprinter, as his Wikipedia entry called him, wasn't very productive for the Ravens. In 5 seasons, he caught just 60 balls for 929 yards and 7 touchdowns. He managed just one catch while suiting up in 4 playoff games, an 8-yard reception in Super Bowl 35. Clue number 5, he wore 3 different numbers with the Ravens, 85 his rookie year, then most prominently number 83, and then when he returned in 2005, he wore number 11. And just as an aside, he definitely wrote his own Wikipedia entry as it refers to him as Mr. Johnson at one point. Oops, kind of gave it away there. But
okay, well, I was not confident, and now I'll just go with mine here because I think Antonio is way more confident still than I am. I am going to go Patrick Johnson.
It is Patrick Johnson. I'm sorry I gave it away there, but that made me laugh so much when I saw that on Wikipedia. I should have obviously saved it. But shocked I haven't done that before, but yeah, Patrick Johnson, he showed up very briefly. He caught the game-winning touchdown from Dilfer against the Titans in their regular season meeting in Nashville in the Bullies of Baltimore documentary, if you watched on Sunday. And you also saw him pushing Shannon Sharp up the field in the AFC title game, and that was his about 2 appearances. Jamal Lewis mentioned him doing that. That was Patrick Johnson's impact on the 2000 Ravens. And, yeah, I believe earlier in the show I said possibly the first Real Ravens wide receiver bust of guys. He was drafted 42nd overall out of Oregon. Didn't do much, but they brought him back, which is fascinating.
I had no, I had no knowledge that he was back on the team.
He was back in 04 too, but he was injured that whole year. So he just like kicked around the practice squad. And then they were like, come on back for 05. So I guess a Brian Billick favorite. I don't know. But yeah, Patrick Johnson, Mr. Johnson on Wikipedia, if you look him up. I was shocked he wasn't on our list because, he's what we're looking for in this segment, which is mainly a failed Ravens wide receiver pick.
the genesis of this idea probably came from that position group. Maybe the first draft bust, as Jace mentioned, not the last. So many followed in those hallowed footsteps. That's it, guys. That's it for us. It's Super Bowl week. Get excited. Make some plans. Get some chips. Get some beer. Hang out with your favorite people and watch what I hope and think will be an awesome game between the two best teams in the NFL, as I mentioned at the top. For Jace Evans and Tim Horsey, I am Antonio Pagliaro. Thank you so much for listening to us on Pod Like a Raven. We will see you next week.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.